Millions of people are living better. They are enjoying a healthier lifestyle, learning more about overcoming obstacles and keeping a positive outlook. Now you can be a member of the club. This is the Living to 100 Club with Dr. Joe Casciani. Our guests share incredible stories and advice, bring new outlooks on wellness, and show you how to keep moving forward. Now, here is your host, Dr. Joe Casciani.
Welcome to the Living to 100 Club radio show on the Voice America Network. And good day to our listeners. I'm Joe Casciani, show host, geropsychologist, and curator of all things that are positive about aging. As you know, the show focuses on successful aging and longevity. And we all know on this bus ride, there are plenty of bumps and potholes and risks that each of us encounters along the way. One strategy to successful aging, of course, is managing these risks as best we can. We have an exciting topic for today's show with our guest, Paul Greenwood, who will help with this. Before we start, I just want to remind our listeners that we're happy to take your questions. Just call them into 866-472-5792. That's 866-472-5792. Or send your question by email to info@living2100.club. And now I'd like to introduce our guest, Paul Greenwood. Let me begin with a brief read of his distinguished legal career. Newly retired Deputy District Attorney Paul Greenwood was a lawyer in England for 13 years. After relocating to San Diego in 1991, he passed the California bar and joined the DA's office in 1993. For 22 years, Paul headed up the Elder Abuse Prosecution Unit at the San Diego DA's office. In 1999, California Lawyer Magazine named Paul as one of their top 20 lawyers of the year in recognition of his pioneering efforts to pursue justice on behalf of senior citizens. He's prosecuted over 750 felony cases of both physical and financial elder abuse. He's also prosecuted 10 murder cases, including one death penalty case. In March 2018, Paul retired from the San Diego DA's office to concentrate on sharing lessons learned from his elder abuse prosecutions with a wider audience. In October 2018, he was given a Lifetime Achievement Award by his former office. Paul now spends much of his post-retirement time consulting on elder abuse cases and providing trainings to law enforcement and adult protective service agencies across the country and internationally. He's also involved as a criminal justice board member of the National Adult Protective Services Association. We're very happy to have you as our guest today, Paul.
Thank you, Joe. It's great to be with you.
Yes, good. This is a long history of investigation and prosecution. Tell our listeners how you got into prosecuting elder abuse.
Yes, I mean, it was totally not for my doing, or because I have to admit that until I was approached by my boss, I had never heard of the term elder abuse, nor did I appreciate that there had been a law in California that had been in existence for over 10 years. And so one day I was just sitting in my office and the call came in from the boss, the DA, saying, meet me in my office in 5 minutes. I walked down there and he told me that Adult Protective Services had called him very annoyed and upset that apparently our office was ignoring a huge escalating crime called elder abuse. So he told them he would fix that problem, and known to me, he had told them he had somebody in mind. So that was it, Joe. I was given this assignment back in January of 1996. I thought then that I would probably do it for about 3 years because I felt that it wasn't exactly one of those career moves that would enhance my sort of visibility in the office, and how wrong I was. Because after a few months, I realized that this was not just a career. This was going to become a lifetime commitment that I was definitely wanting to make a difference.
Wow. So what did you think it was going to be like when you started? And then what was it really like?
Yeah, exactly. Well, unfortunately, I was persuaded by some of my colleagues in the DA's office who were convincing me that I was being punished for something that I didn't realize what I had done wrong. They were almost making fun of it by saying, you're doing elder abuse, you know, and then they were saying, well, you know, good luck with that. And I kind of bought into that at first, thinking that this was going to be a backwards prosecution. And then after a few weeks and realizing, my goodness, here is an opportunity to actually try to make a difference, because what I was hearing in the community from many members of the public, from Adult Protective Services particularly, is that these crimes against older citizens were being ignored by traditional law enforcement. And so I decided, you know what, this is an opportunity to make an impact. And I went into it full blast. And boy, I mean, it was such a learning curve, Joe, but I'm so glad that I was given this opportunity. And it's been just an eye-opener for me over the last 23 years involved in it.
Wow. Yeah, so some of the best-kept secrets early on when there was this going, you know, occurring in our city and county, and not a lot of press about it. So you were in on the kind of the leading edge there. So what kind of challenges did you come across when you got started?
Well, the main challenge, Joe, and it probably still is today for most jurisdictions in the United States and across the globe, which is the barrier of silence, the silence that comes from older victims of these crimes, you know, the silence that comes from law enforcement, from prosecutors, from other people who should be reporting these crimes to law enforcement. And often it's not through any malicious ill will towards older adults. It's simply through lack of understanding, lack of training, and sometimes, unfortunately, falling into terrible misconceptions about what an elder abuse case looks like and the viability of presenting such a case in a criminal courtroom. And so that was the initial challenge that I had, which was how to overcome this barrier of silence. And fortunately, Joe, I was at an age and of an experience as a lawyer that I wasn't afraid to go out into the community and listen to what some of the concerns were. And the other great thing, Joe, was because it was a brand new program, nobody could accuse me of doing it wrong, because nobody had anything to compare it to. So I had that going for me, that I was able to, as it were, break through new barriers without having to be compared to what had gone before.
Hmm. So did you find some of the silence on the part of the consumers as well as the kind of agencies, state and federal, even county agencies, where was there a lot of just kind of discomfort with this whole notion, and let's not bring it to the forefront? I mean, was it on all levels or mostly? Yeah, okay.
Yeah. It was a mixture of both. I'll start with the victims of these elder abuse crimes. Many of them remained anonymous, stayed silent because of either embarrassment, because the perpetrator was actually a family member, typically a son or a daughter or a grandson, and they just didn't want this, as it were, dirty laundry to be aired in public. So there was that embarrassment factor, but then there was secondly, by victims, a fear factor on two levels, a fear that by coming forward, they would be perceived as being vulnerable and therefore in need of added protection from the government, for example, by being displaced out of their homes and being put into a nice, safe, assisted living facility, or a fear that the perpetrator would cause some kind of retaliation against them for making that report. So those were the initial issues that I dealt with victims. On the side of the agencies who should be investigating these cases and following through with them, it was simply a lack of training and a lack of appreciation that a prosecutor would be able to take the facts and mold them into a viable, prosecutable case. And so I spent a lot of my time trying to reassure these agencies, look, you got nothing to lose. You do your work. You bring me whatever facts you have, and let me figure out whether or not this is something that I can present to a jury. And then that's basically what the first year in 1996 was all about. And then by the end of that year, we had 17 cases that I had presented, all of which ended up in, I think most of them ended up in convictions. And so that was a positive start, which then snowballed from there.
Sure, sure. Yeah, now I've heard you present, Paul, on a lot of cases and your strategies. So you talked about coming up with some successful strategies to prosecuting. Now, how did you become known for these different strategies, or what was it that you were doing different that had such a positive effect?
Right. I'm sorry to say that the way that sort of it spread, the news spread, was because sadly, very, very few prosecutors across the country were ever presenting such cases in a criminal court. And that was the cry that I was hearing, not just within San Diego County, but throughout the state of California and then further afield. And little by little, and bearing in mind that this was 1996, before social media was ever invented, it was kind of word of mouth through telephone calls, through journalists picking up on the fact that there was a spike in prosecutions in San Diego, that this kind of trickled through the media into mainstream America. And within a couple of years, Joe, I was then starting to be invited to present what I was learning from San Diego at other state jurisdictions, primarily from adult protective service agencies who were caseworkers who were dedicated but very frustrated. And they kept telling Paul, I just wish my prosecutor would see it that way, or I wish my law enforcement would understand that these cases are prosecutable. So, and I have to stress, Joe, it really wasn't anything to do with anything that I was presenting in court. It was just being willing to take that first step of believing in my victims, believing that jurors would believe my victims, and then letting the victims tell their story in court. And once you do that, it's amazing how often jurors actually understand that.
Well, sure. So really putting the spotlight more on the criminal prosecution than just a civil dispute or a civil case, that was one of the kind of benchmarks that you were able to work with.
It was, Joe. And if there's one particular response that I would be getting from adult protective services across the country, it was this. Mr. Greenwood, all we hear from law enforcement when we present a case to them, is, particularly if it's a financial elder abuse case, they would say, no, this is just a civil matter. And that's the phrase that I heard time and time again. It is just a civil matter.
Mm. Wow. Yeah, so that, I'm not an attorney, so I don't know all the implications, but it sounds like you just kind of brought it into a whole new theater of where to work and new fertile ground to help your colleagues and to emphasize the criminal nature. And did the other states have laws like California about reporting elder abuse?
Well, they do. One problem is that it's not a consistent definition of what, quote, elder abuse crime is. Some states don't use the term elder. They use what is known as a vulnerable adult, which could be any age from 18 upwards. But then the prosecutor has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there are certain elements that attach to the victim, such as certain physical or mental disabilities. Thankfully, in California, we don't use that. We only use an age-based definition. So all I had to prove were two things, that the victim was over the age of 65, and secondly, that the defendant knew or reasonably should have known that his victim was over the age of 65. And one other point that you made just now when you said you're not a lawyer, and that was what I was telling in a sensitive manner the police departments around California and the country. I was saying, look, I have the greatest respect for what you do, but what you are not trained to do is be a lawyer. And so when you tell a member of the public this is just a civil matter. You are actually taking the place of a lawyer, and you shouldn't be doing that. So let me be the person to determine if it's civil or criminal. I want you to gather the facts and just bring them to in whatever shape they come. And that's really the message I have for every police department across the country.
Sure. Yeah, I can see that distinction, and really educating them that it's not up to them to make the decision. It's up to an attorney or, you know, someone with a DA's office to make that determination. Yeah, it's similar to, you know, when mental health professionals hear about suspected abuse, child abuse or whatever. It's not up to us to decide the case. It's up to us to really make the report and let the experts make that determination. It's not up to us. We just have to file the report. Interesting.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, the big thing is, just like with child abuse or domestic violence, this takes a team effort, and it takes people from all these different fields, from law enforcement, from the mental health components, who can actually give me an opinion as to the competency or the level of cognitive ability of the victim, to the emergency room physician or nurse who can determine if the wounds appear to be self-inflicted or accidental or deliberate. And then financial institutions who can red flag a suspicious transaction. So it really takes, within a jurisdiction, a multidisciplinary approach to bring these cases into a criminal courtroom.
Fascinating. So we have a break coming up. I know we're going to get into some of the specifics and more examples and some of the misconceptions about these investigations. But let me just take a break here. This is Joe Casciani, and my guest is Paul Greenwood. You're listening to the Living to 100 Club on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Stay tuned. We have much more ahead.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Visit the Living to 100 Club online store. We feature products and wellness information that help maintain healthy lifestyles, promote mental and physical fitness, and allow you to take control of your future. You'll find a wide array of affordable items for staying active, monitoring your health, and adapting to physical changes. Most popular are items for travel, even with your pets, exercise equipment and clothing, heart rate monitors, and personal care items, and our unique Yes, I'm Positive collection. The Living to 100 Club Store offers convenient solutions for active lifestyles. Be sure to spend time on our Learn page for the club's inspiring blog series and add your name to our email list. The Living to 100 Club online store for awareness, convenience, and independence. Find us at livingto100.club. That's livingto100.club.
Are you living a healthy and fit lifestyle? It's not just related to your physical well-being. It also means a healthier mind, confidence, improved health, stamina, and fitness. Talking with Tremaine brings it all to you. Host Tremaine Ellis, along with her husband and co-host David Ellis, will offer support, advice, guidance, and motivation to keep you in your best shape, both physically and mentally. Talking with Tremaine can be heard live every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time and 3 Pacific on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
Real Life Solutions, Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are listening to the Living to 100 Club with Dr. Joe Casciani. To reach the program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to info@living2100.club. Now, back to this week's show.
All right, we're back. Paul, let's pick up where we left off. I know you and I had talked a little bit about a lot of the misconceptions that come into investigating elder abuse cases. What do you see as some of the common misconceptions about these investigations?
Sure, and unfortunately, they arise with law enforcement and with prosecutors. And the number one misconception, which I heard time and time again as I first started approaching these agencies to ask them why I wasn't seeing any reports, was that, well, Greenwood, they would tell me, you don't want to deal with older victims. And I said, well, why not? And they would say, well, they're so forgetful, they're not credible, and they would give me all these stereotypes of what an older adult is supposed to behave like. And thankfully, Joe, I've been raised by two parents who, my mother is still alive, she's 95, still mentally sharp. And so I have always been a great positive believer in positive aging. And so I said to these folks, you know what, I'm interested in going further with this. Why do you believe that they are forgetful at age 85 or 90? Just bring me the facts and let me decide if I can put this case on. And I can honestly tell you, in 22 years of presenting cases, Joe, into a criminal courtroom where my victims have ranged between 65 and 102, that in only rare circumstances has it been a disadvantage to put them on the stand. In most of my cases, they have absolutely shone as great victims, as people who can recount the trauma or the details of the event that made them a victim. So I ever since starting those few cases, I have gone around absolutely encouraging law enforcement, telling them that's a misconception, don't believe it, don't buy into it. And then the second misconception was that if you get a victim who has been victimized primarily by their own family member, and the victim tells the police officer, well, you know what, yeah, it happened, but I don't want anything to happen to my son. He's a good boy when he's not drunk or such and such. And then they basically tell the police officer to close the investigation. That is something that I've railed against, and I have told law enforcement, no, we're not going to let victims choose which cases I get to prosecute. Because even though there are many victims who disagreed with my initial decision to file a prosecution, in most times when the case was resolved and the son was placed upon formal probation by a judge with strict conditions to help overcome the son's drug or alcohol or gambling addiction, the victim would ultimately realize that the prosecution actually was in the son's best interest. And so that's how I would try to convince my victims that number one, I'm not going to budge. I am going to prosecute your son. But number two, I'm doing it so that your son can become a productive member of society in a few years' time once he has dealt with his addiction. Now, obviously, you can't do that when it's a very serious crime where there's lots of prison time. But with most of these crimes that I prosecuted, sometimes it was a son for whom it was his first conviction. He'd stolen from his mother because of a drug habit. And what you're trying to do is really help that son break free. And the only way you can really do it is by having a judge tell him that he's got two choices. He can either follow the program, or if he falls off, he can go to prison. And that is a great incentive to most of these sons.
Sure. That's one way to get to it. So I can really see that, where the victim makes the report, complains about abuse, and then kind of rethinks it or walks it back. They want to protect their son, or they want to protect the other individual. And then you're there helping them to see that that's not the answer. That's not the solution. It's a it's a quick fix, but it's not going to help things down the road. So I can see that.
Exactly. And how it normally transpires is there's been an incident in the home. The older adult calls 911, as they should, and the police officer arrives, arrests the son, or whoever it is, takes them out in handcuffs, and 2 or 3 hours go by, and then the first thing that the son will do when he is booked into jail will make a collect call back to his mother and will say, "Mom, you will regret this for the rest of your life. I'm being kept in terrible conditions. This is awful. You've got to tell the DA that you're not going to go ahead with prosecution." And so I get the call the next morning from the mother telling me that. And so that's the kind of stuff that you understand and you deal with. But you have to stay firm and realize that my duty as a prosecutor is not just to the victim, it's to the community at large.
Mm. Sure, but I'm sure there are a number of cases where they did not want to press charges, and the son or whoever got to them and pressed their buttons, and they said, "No, I'm going to drop the charges." And sometimes I would imagine hard to change that attitude.
It is hard to change, but that's where we became more proactive, Joe, in the San Diego DA's office, because in those instances where the mother would get to the police detective first and tell the detective, "I want to drop the charges," the detective would then write that in his report or her report and then close the case. Well, what we did, we sent a victim advocate down to the police station, and her primary responsibility was to look at every police report that was generated from the previous week where the age of the victim was over 65. And if she came across a report that basically said that, "I'm closing the case because the victim doesn't want to press charges," she would photocopy it and then bring it to me. And then we would resurrect that investigation and actually bring it to my office. And where possible, we would actually prosecute the case with or without the victim's assistance.
Sure. Makes a lot of sense.
Now that's kind of revolutionary for most prosecutors.
Yeah.
And across the globe, for example, in the UK, where I'm originally from, Australia, where I'm about to go and speak, and in Canada, this is not the norm. They are typically allowing victims to dictate whether or not charges get filed. So this is a controversial tactic, but I'm absolutely convinced that this is the right tactic because, Joe, this is my fear. If we don't prosecute a son who commits this first act of abuse against his mother and we allow him to get away with it, it sends him a signal. And then what I fear is that it will happen again, and next time it will be worse. And next time it could be a homicide rather than just a physical assault.
Sure. Wow. Yeah, so that was a real innovation when you were able to head off some of those decisions and at least have another shot at getting the person to maintain their charges. That's good.
It was. And, you know, there's also something about the fact that as a prosecutor, fortunately in San Diego, we have what is called civil service protection, where you're not at the whim of being hired or fired by your boss. Not that I ever had a bad boss. I had wonderful bosses. But the thing is, it gives me the freedom to do what I believe is in the best interest of the community without fear of what my bosses think. You know, because often my victims would call my bosses and be angry and upset because I was going against their wishes. But this is where you take a line and say, this is for the protection not only of the victim, but for the protection of the public in general.
Mm. Yeah. So they gave you that latitude. Your superiors knew enough about your judgment, your professional judgment, and they backed you up on that, even if they got a lot of pushback.
Didn't. And I think that's what makes San Diego a wonderful place to work as a prosecutor. We are known across the country as being a stellar office, and it's true. They allow you your skill and judgment to make right decisions. Obviously, you know, they want us to go to them if it's a close call, and it's good to get other people's perspective. But in both of the cases, it was pretty clear cut to me what we needed to do.
Mm-hmm. So I'm interested. I believe our audience would be interested in hearing some of the profiles. What are some of the cases? What are some of the similarities that you would see? You did, 750 prosecutions. You came across a lot of variability, I'm sure, but there are also a lot of underlying commonalities. What are some of those common situations? Yeah.
Thank you. And there's kind of two that I want to talk about. The first one is relating to physical abuse, and the second, which is by family members, and the second one is financial exploitation by caregivers. So dealing first with the physical abuse, I came across and prosecuted so many cases of typically a son, sometimes a daughter, sometimes a grandson or a granddaughter, who had physically assaulted an elderly parent or grandparent, typically by punching them in the eye, causing abrasions, broken bones, black eye, or worse, pushing them by at which time the victim would fall and break a hip, or even worse, getting a hard, blunt object like a crowbar or a hammer and actually smashing the skull and murdering them. And that typical profile of the family member was somebody who was living at the parent's home, who was literally sponging off the parent, who was battling their own addictions. It was either drugs, alcohol, or gambling, where they were, for example, a 46-year-old son, unemployed. And when I would talk to the victim, and it was, again, typically an elderly widowed mother in her early 80s or late 70s, and I would say to her, why is it that your son, who's 46, living at home with you, why is he unemployed? And they would typically, Joe, give me the same response. Well, Mr. Greenwood, he tells me he has a medical condition that prevents him from working. And I would say, well, let me guess. Does he complain that he has a bad back? And they would look at me in astonishment and say, how did you know? And I said, well, I'm sorry. It comes from sitting on your sofa 8 hours a day playing video games. And I know I was being a little facetious there, but I saw this time and time again. Every single one of these defendants who was a family member who caused physical assault was lazy, and all they were doing was mooching off their elderly parent. And how it would arise to a physical assault is that they would be stealing their mother's jewelry out of their bedroom, pawning it to get cash to feed their addiction, or they would be stealing the ATM debit card and using that at the bank or at the casino to feed the addiction. And when mother found out, she would confront the perpetrator, and that's where the argument began, which then would escalate to physical altercation. We would see that week in and week out, Joe, and that's why your listeners, if they hear this description and it reminds them of either somebody in their own family or somebody living next door, it should immediately set off red flags and alarm bells. And I hope that then your listener would do the right thing and make a call to Adult Protective Services in their jurisdiction to say, mm-hmm. I'm concerned about my neighbor or my family member. So that's the first profile. The second profile is the caregiver who is stealing from the older adult. Unfortunately, Joe, we don't have very good rules that mandate rigorous background checks on caregivers in jurisdictions. And very often, I would be prosecuting a paid caregiver who had a prior criminal record, and they may be battling with their own drug addiction or gambling addiction, and it would be so easy for them in the privacy of somebody's home to come in, again, steal the jewelry or steal a check, steal an asset, and then use it to further and feed their own addictions. So these were things that I would be constantly warning and educating adult children about, who might be about ready to hire a caregiver for an older parent. And there were certain tips that maybe we can go into later that I would give to older, to adult children on what to do before a caregiver comes into the home.
I'm just thinking it's got to be hard to quantify when it crosses over that line into abuse, financial abuse. I mean, especially if it's a family member. I mean, not a paid caregiver, but an unpaid caregiver. If they're borrowing money or taking money, I'm sure it's got to be hard to know where to draw the line.
It can be, but it helps when I can trace where the money is going. So if it's going straight out of the home into a casino for gambling or to purchase a luxury car, and this is clearly not for the benefit of the victim, in most cases, it's not difficult to be able to prove that this money or asset was taken without the victim's consent for the benefit of the suspect. Mm. What is difficult is where, on the surface, it appears to be a loan or a gift, because that's what the suspect will say immediately. Oh, no, I was just borrowing it. I was going to repay it. So you have to be very creative and look for other evidence which would actually refute the idea that this was going to be repaid at some point in time. And this is where you have to go and encourage law enforcement to keep pushing, keep prodding, keep asking questions, rather than just close the case as being unfounded.
Yeah. A lot of work, a lot of investigative work that goes into these cases. I know we'll talk more about the red flags. There's got to be certain trends that, as you say, if you're aware of certain things going on, or we'll get to talk about that after we come back from the break. But I'd love to hear more about the red flags and also some of the ways that, more creative ways that older adults are being scammed in the community. We hear a lot about the phone calls from the IRS and the insurance companies and all that. So maybe you can touch on that a little bit when we come back. Time to take a short break. This is Joe Casciani, and my guest is Paul Greenwood. You're listening to the Living to 100 Club on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Stay tuned. We have much more ahead. Thank you.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Visit the Living to 100 Club online store. We feature products and wellness information that help maintain healthy lifestyles, promote mental and physical fitness, and allow you to take control of your future. You'll find a wide array of affordable items for staying active, monitoring your health, and adapting to physical changes. Most popular are items for travel, even with your pets, exercise equipment and clothing, heart rate monitors, and personal care items, and our unique Yes, I'm Positive collection. The Living to 100 Club Store offers convenient solutions for active lifestyles. Be sure to spend time on our Learn page for the club's inspiring blog series and add your name to our email list. The Living to 100 Club online store for awareness, convenience, and independence. Find us at livingto100.club. That's livingto100.club.
Do you feel that you aren't at your best when it comes to your personal health? Even if your doctor gives you a clean bill of health and says everything is in working order, perhaps you aren't feeling at the top of your game. Dr. Rebecca Risk overcame pain and fatigue despite all tests to the contrary. Learn how she put her health back on track and how you can too on Falling Through the Cracks. Live every Monday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, 12 noon Eastern Time on Voice America Health and Wellness.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are listening to the Living to 100 Club with Dr. Joe Casciani. To reach the program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to info@livingto100.club. Now, back to this week's show.
Okay, and we're back. Paul, let's pick up again. We were starting to touch on some of the red flags, some of the patterns to look for where there could be some of this abuse going on in the background. What do you recommend to be on the lookout for?
Yes. I always tell particularly adult children, the first sign that something may be wrong is where the older adult's typical pattern of behavior changes, where they become less communicative, where they might even become a little more isolated. And that typically has been caused by a third party moving into the older adult's life. Maybe it's an estranged relative who suddenly come out of the woodwork after 25 years coming from a state, or it may be a neighbor that it decides that they like the look of some of the things that the victim owns. And so if you find that now you're no longer able to have frequent calls or visits with this person, then that definitely is a red flag. Mm. Mm. You know, I can't tell you, Joe, how many times I would get calls from adult children calling me, telling me to prosecute somebody that they had discovered had been stealing from their elderly mother or father over the last 12 or 15 months. And I would let them tell the story, and then I would interrupt and say, well, you know, where are you when all this was going on? And then, of course, they would give me every excuse under the sun why they weren't involved in their elderly parents' life. You know, these predators, and I do call them that, predators have a knack of identifying the perfect victim in waiting, somebody whose own family has not fulfilled their duty to stay in touch, or the family that is easily rebuffed with a phone call saying, no, no, don't visit, she's under the weather, things like that. So I always tell people, stay engaged in your older relative's life as much as you can. And if you can't be there physically, then you need to have a buddy system in place where you can send somebody over who can make an unannounced visit to make sure that this relative is doing all right. Another red flag would be indications of financial problems. I've had victims literally go to a neighbor and say, can I borrow $500 just for this month because they're having trouble paying their utility bill? And that is clearly a sign that they've been scammed or exploited in some way. Or thirdly, where you suddenly see a change in their physical appearance, a loss of weight, or it appears that cognitively they are a little more confused. Or if you pay a visit to their home and you see mail accumulating, or you hear phone ringing constantly, that those two things could be an indication that somebody has already got their claws into the older adult. But really, it is just for all of us to keep our ears and eyes open. And the worst thing we can do is to say, it's none of my business. If we suspect that something is not quite right, all we need to do is make a call to local adult protective services and tell them your concerns and let them figure it out and make a visit. And of course, they will not let on who made that initial call.
Sure. Yeah. So the predators have a way of seeing the vulnerability, the gap or the vacuum that you mentioned, that they know there's nobody around or none of the adult children are very close to the potential victim. So that's some useful advice for us to pay attention and be alert to those possible situations. We hear a lot about.
Go ahead. Particularly in, for example, assisted living or nursing home facilities where I've prosecuted employees, they have always targeted the victim who never gets a visit from anybody. And that is the sitting target right there.
Mm-hmm. The most vulnerable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are some of the newer ways, more social media or kind of trendy ways that seniors are being scammed or exploited?
I'm glad you raised that, because the number one, the hottest issue right now with social media, actually through the internet and somewhat through Instagram, is the sweetheart. I've had talks with so many older adults, primarily they're in their late 60s, 68, 69, 70, who have either been widowed, who've lost their life partner, or have recently been with somebody, or just got divorced. And naturally, they're on the rebound. They want to look for a new relationship. But unfortunately, what they're doing is they're looking in the wrong places. They're looking on websites, and they are being hooked by people who have this profile online that looks so wonderful with photographs and everything. But these crooks are actually anonymous. They've stolen the identity or the profile of the person they are convincing the victim that they are, and they'll never, ever meet the victim. They'll string them along to the point where they'll suddenly tell the victim, oh, I just have to go out of the country. I'm an engineer. I'm going to go to Malaysia for 2 months, and then the week later they say, oh, you'll never guess, I've just been robbed. I need money. Can you help me? Or I need this. And then you get this victim totally besotted with this person they've never met, and they end up sending them thousands of dollars. Wow. And you know, you think, how can that be? But I've talked to well-educated people, professionals who are retired people. They have fallen for this because they have been convinced by the predator that they love them and they're going to spend the rest of their life with them as soon as this job overseas is completed. Mm. So that is the one thing I always talk about. Then, of course, the other big scam is the grandma scam, where the perpetrator calls up the elderly person, portrays themselves as a grandson who is in prison in an overseas country, that he's in jail, that he doesn't want mum and dad to find out, but he does need bail money of about $5,000. And grandma, you're the only one who can help. Grandma will then respond, but it doesn't sound like you, Jimmy. And then he'll come up with a perfect explanation as to how his voice sounds different. And then he'll convince her to go to the bank, withdraw the money, and then wire the money or purchase iTunes gift cards and give the numbers over the phone to a third party. Again, the victims who fall for this are intelligent, articulate. The only thing they're guilty of is they're people who love their grandchildren to such an extent that the logic leaves them. They're so afraid that their grandchild is in jail that they just want to help immediately.
Yeah, yeah. And they're so creative. I know we hear about these on the news from time to time, and the scam artist is, you know, just so resourceful, and they make a very compelling argument. And, you know, as you say, the victim is bright, intelligent, and kind of good common sense individual, but just the same, they get pulled into this, and you say, well, how did you, didn't you stop and think there? But I guess it could happen. It happens all the time.
It does, and then when it happens to somebody like that, of course, when they discover that it was a scam, the first thing they do is stay silent. They don't want their family. They don't want law enforcement or me to find out, because they fear that we're going to, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, move in and convince them that, well, you need protection. And of course, that's not anything that we talk about with them, but that's their fear.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we have just a few minutes left. Tell us, after your years of experience and kind of what you've learned, how do we prevent this? What steps can we take to protect ourselves, protect others from this type of abuse, exploitation? being scammed.
And I'm glad we're finishing on this note, Joe, because the last thing I want people to take away from this program is that it's a depressing subject. It's not. What it is providing us with information. And growing older, I'm looking forward to it. I'm 67 now. I'm at a stage of my life where I'm enjoying it, and I want to be able to remain victim-free for the rest of my life. But to do that, we've got to be sensible. We've got to take precautions. And some of the precautions I tell people are, number one, choose a caregiver with great caution. Always insist on interviewing the owner of the agency. Don't ever hire anybody through Craigslist or through a newspaper ad or through word of mouth. Only go through a bonded, insured agency. I then say, lock up your jewelry at all times and keep an inventory of your jewelry, because the number one item that is stolen from senior citizens in the USA is jewelry. So keep it documented, because in the event that any of it goes missing, at least you can produce that inventory to a police officer and say, this is what's missing. I also say, protect your credit. Make sure that you either sign up for a credit protection service, and there's several in the market there that you can choose from, or at least, the very least we can do, is do our own credit searches on ourselves at least 3 times a year. We need to go to Equifax and TransUnion to make sure that we are not already being targeted by somebody. So you need to also think about freezing your credit, because if you're not going to be in the market for opening up a new credit card account or getting a new department store financial account, then freeze your credit so that nobody else can get hold of it. Another tip that I give to people is protect your mail. Don't ever leave outgoing mail in your mailbox with the red flag sticking up, because I'm convinced that that red flag was invented by a crook anyway. Always take it to a secure location, particularly when you have a check in the mail. And with your incoming mail, always try to get a secure locked mailbox rather than leave it open to chance, because I tell you, they do have people who come around and steal from the mailboxes. And then another thing, I do like every senior citizen, if possible, if they can afford it, to have one of those video cameras installed in the front door and in the house or in the apartment, so that we can see who's coming to the door. When a crook comes to the door and they see they're being videoed, they typically will not bother the victim. And I think that's just a safe, sensible way of reducing the risk of becoming the next victim. And then ultimately, Joe, if any of us become victims, the worst thing we can do is to stay silent. Please talk to somebody about what has happened, and let them make the judgment call on what to do next, because we've got to hold the perpetrators accountable for their actions.
Well, great advice. Thank you very much, Paul. Looks like we're out of time for today, unfortunately. Maybe we'll get you back sometime. Thank you for being our guest.
Because as you know, there's lots more that we can talk about. And, you know, if any of your listeners have questions, I know you're going to give out some contact information for me. Email is the best. But I'm happy, at no charge, just to talk to people on email if they have a concern.
Good. Yeah, let me give our audience your number. You can be texted at 858-386-6500. And your email is pgreendda@gmail.com. So pgreendda@gmail.com. Special thanks to all of our listeners for being a part of today's show. Please visit our website at living200.club. Sign up for our email list. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Casciani. You've been listening to the Living 200 Club. Be sure to join us next week. We have an exciting guest who will talk about yoga and what yoga can teach us about living 200. A closing thought in honor of our guest being from England. The English writer and poet Samuel Johnson had a great quote: whatever enlarges hope will also exalt courage. So I leave that closing thought with you. Whatever enlarges hope will also exalt courage. Thank you all for being a part of our show.
thank you for being part of the Living to 100 Club. We hope you'll join Dr. Joe Casciani again next Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Until next week, stay on the right track to mental and physical fitness.